Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and today we're going to begin our program by talking with you about the Great American Chestnut Tree. It's a beautiful tree. How many people have actually seen a chestnut tree? Not as many as had at one time, I think. I was trying to recall the poem, "Under the Spreading Chestnut Tree, the Village Smithy Stands," and I remember the drawing that came along with that poem of the blacksmith under this enormous, enormous tree. They're beautiful trees. Doug Beagie thinks they're beautiful, too. He's an environmental philosopher with training in botany and genetics. He's authored the book, If a Tree Falls, Rediscovering the Great American Chestnut Tree. And his previous writings have examined the relationship between humans and their natural surroundings. And his first book, If a Tree Falls, Rediscovering the Great American Chestnut, is recently out, and we're really pleased to have him with us today to talk about it. Douglas Beagie, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Larry. Just a minor correction. The poem, Under the Spreading Chestnut Tree, written about horse chestnut.
It was about horse chestnuts.
Completely different genus.
Well, there...
No threat to horse chestnuts around.
But there is a threat to the American chestnut. And, you know, you've have some botany training and so forth, but how did you get interested in this, the American chestnut?
Well, you know, I've been looking for a book topic for years after I finished my doctoral dissertation in environmental philosophy, and I just kind of drifted around, and at some point one of my coworkers mentioned, you know, there's a guy out west, west part of the state, growing chestnuts. And I thought, really? I didn't think that anybody had those around. So I went out to see him, Mark Shepard, who's written about in the book, and we toured his property, and I learned about his chestnuts, and he told me about a guy in southeast Minnesota, Phil Rutter, who's also breeding chestnuts and hazelnuts. So then I went out to see Phil, and every time I'd go a little further from home and I'd learn more about the whole story, I'd just kind of get drawn in.
And they're remarkable trees. The size of a mature chestnut, it gets an almost unbelievable size.
Yeah, people have called them the redwood of the East, which is pretty misleading because the redwood's a seriously giant tree. But in the East Coast, the Eastern Seaboard, Appalachians, the chestnut was one of the largest trees available. It had an ecological advantage because it grew faster than oaks, twice as fast as oaks. And so these trees had an ability to just shoot for the canopy. So like you said, one out of four trees from Maine to Georgia in the mountainous regions was a chestnut.
And they were first on the East Coast, but moved kind of across the country then.
The furthest west they got, they would have been in eastern parts of Indiana and extreme little pockets of southeastern Illinois would have been about as close as they got to us. Mm-hmm. Except for in the late 1800s, a settler from New York State, a guy named Martin Hicks, moved to West Salem, which is right outside of La Crosse. And he brought with him, like settlers do, part of the home.
Yeah.
And so he brought a bunch of seedlings. We think they're seedlings, probably not seed. That wouldn't have been as likely. But on the back row of his property, he planted 10 of these chestnut trees.
And from there, we have chestnuts in parts of Wisconsin.
Yeah, that original row of trees, chestnuts are really fast mover for trees.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have about 75 acres of chestnut trees out in West Salem. It's the largest stand of chestnuts, American chestnuts, still available in the world. Except in about 1975, those trees finally got hit by the same disease that had hit the other trees, the chestnut blight.
And that's why the chestnut tree is not with us as much as it was in the past.
In part, in 1904, the chestnut blight was found on trees at the New York Botanical Garden, and it really moved fast. It just plowed through like a wildfire. And by the 1940s, almost all the chestnut trees were gone. There were still random survivors. But as the book points out, it wasn't necessarily only the disease, but it was the way that humans responded to the disease. They saw, for example, Sagamore Estates, where the Roosevelts had land in Long Island, they saw their trees were getting sick, and they had a lot of money to pump into it, so they tried to save their trees. It didn't work. But other places, people that had chestnut, they realized, here's a disease, it's going to hurt my trees, I better cash in. So a lot of people just cut their chestnuts out and sold the wood while they could to make a fast profit. And I point out in the book, Philip Rutter, who is from Minnesota, a plant breeder, very sharp guy. I liked spending time with him. And he's studied this, and he's got something he calls Rutter's Rule. And basically it says, you know, trees get a disease. His rule is, if it's not dead, don't kill it. Now, he believes that you should let a disease kind of run its course and keep track of it, because trees or any other species will develop or may develop a natural resistance to it. Mm-hmm. Or insects might come and infect and help the tree survive. And he's done a very similar work. Besides his chestnuts, when he bought his land in the 70s, he noticed there were butternuts, American butternuts. About the same time in the 70s, blight hit butternuts. And he watched all the butternuts on his property succumb to the blight.
Oh, boy.
But over the decades, his butternuts, untouched, he does nothing with them, they've recovered. Somehow they have figured out how to beat the blight. And he says, Rutter believes if we'd done that with American chestnut blight, the tree might have found its own way to survive. But we were, you know... We were seeking dollars for that wood. If you had 150 acres of chestnut, you wanted to make some money off of it before all you had was rotted timber.
Yeah. So. Douglas Beege, our guest today, author of If a Tree Falls, Rediscovering the Great American Chestnut. If you'd like to join in, we have some callers online. We'll get to them right now, as a matter of fact. But if you want to join in, there's a line open at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. 1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's take a couple of calls here. Mimi in Reesburg, we'll go to you. Mimi, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I have the opposite problem. I have too many chestnut trees. There's a stand of trees in the Reesburg School Forest outside of Rock Springs, and my friend Denise and I go every fall and try to beat the squirrels to the nuts, and then I send a lot of them off to the American Chestnut Foundation, but I keep some in the refrigerator, and I plant them in the spring, and I now have three nursery beds of little chestnut trees for which I would like to find some homes.
Oh, wonderful.
Adopt a chestnut. Good idea.
So you have some available if people are interested.
Yes, yes.
Have you had them checked to make sure they're American chestnut?
Yes. Cameron Gunderson came out from the American Chestnut Foundation, and we sent off some twigs to their research facility, where I guess they did whatever they needed to study, their DNA or whatever, and they did say, yes, they are American chestnut.
Well, that's exactly what you want to do is, you know, for other listeners, too, that think they might have an American chestnut, there are places like the American Chestnut Foundation. You can send twigs with leaves, possibly flowers or burrs if you have them, and you can find out, do you actually have an American chestnut, or is it a Chinese or a Japanese chestnut? In this case, since you do have American chestnuts, and it sounds like you've probably got a little pocket of area where you don't have blight,
right?
You've got a great source of original genetic material, and American Chestnut Foundation is obviously very happy to have a source of that. The American Chestnut Cooperators Foundation would probably also be quite interested in that. That's a different organization, also based in Virginia. But with a very different approach, as I spell out in the book. And one of the things, if people are interested in getting chestnuts, it's probably a good idea to be careful. Because, like, when the blight moved around, people were selling chestnut, and that helped spread the blight to new areas.
Yeah. Sure.
So in your case, boy, that's... So the American Chestnut Foundation and the American Chestnut Cooperators Foundation. So those are two distinct, as you point out in your book, foundations with, and hopefully, Mimi, you can get in touch with the other group.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'll check them out online, because I would, at this point, my problem is that I have trees, not nuts. In the fall, I will have nuts, which are much easier to send to people. But at this point, I'm not in a position to be, you know, boxing up seedlings and sending them off to people.
Well, sure.
I could haul some down. I took some down for a fellow who's been a guest of yours before, Larry, Bruce Allison, who's written about the champion trees.
Yes.
And I met him down in Madison and gave him some chestnut trees. And I could bring some, you know, to exchange with people, you know, like a drug exchange, you know, in a parking lot in Madison. you know, I'd be happy to do that, but I really am not in, you know.
Please don't cross any international borders.
For immoral purposes.
Because that actually is a problem,
Moving
plant material over borders. A lot of people think it's a safe thing, but it really isn't.
Yeah, and I worry about, you know, am I doing the species a favor by disseminating these seeds, or am I doing the blight a favor?
That's a really good question, and part of the answer is the blight is going to be existent in the soil or on other plants. The blight's got a life of its own. It doesn't require chestnut to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the fear of moving the blight around is kind of artificial. It's kind of like the flu.
Yeah.
You know, it's an invisible enemy. You can't defeat it in the traditional ways that you'd like to. So I wouldn't be so concerned about that. I do think moving the chestnut around, you should know where they go. Keeping records. Now, there's a gentleman, Ed Hasselkus, who's a local Madison guy, who's worked with chestnuts at the UW Arboretum. And in the 1970s, he did a survey of all the chestnuts in Wisconsin. And it's very valuable to have that.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've toured around. I can even tell you, Madison people, 311 North Few Street, if you want to see an American chestnut, there's a traditional-looking chestnut there, 311 North Few Street, which is near Tenney Park.
Mm-hmm.
And also there are, I believe, five of them in the Arboretum, but there are smaller orchard-shaped tree. But Mimi, my email I'll give you, please drop me a line.
Sure.
Is Douglas?
Hang on just a second. Okay. Douglas.
At djbuege.com.
Okay.
Yeah, please do, Mimi.
I will, because I would love to hook these little trees up with people who would appreciate them and protect them. And
absolutely.
Yeah, and anybody else that's interested in scoring some chestnut, as you put it, can contact me at that email address.
Great. Then you can pimp for my trees.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether these are blight-resistant chestnuts or simply that they were an isolated pocket and they were spared for that reason.
Most likely a isolated pocket here in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Yeah. But the trees are great mature trees, and they are you're absolutely right. They are a beautiful sight.
Yeah. Thank you, Mimi.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Don in Warren, Illinois, will turn to you next. Hi, Don.
Hi, fellas. Before I get off on a tangent here, one of my frustrating subjects, why have they not fused the gene from the Chinese chestnut into the American chestnut, the one that will resist blight? If Monsanto can do that with soybeans and with corn, is it just money?
It is just money.
If
you'd like to map the genome of any type of organism, you're going to invest millions and millions of dollars.
That's why they get $285 for quad cross corn.
That is exactly why, because they have invested the money and they want a payoff. They'd like to make a profit. The American chestnut does not offer the same amount of profit that corn, soybeans, mice, or humans offer. And in fact, there are still major debates about the genetics of blight resistance in chestnut tree. Some people say it's two genes that are involved. Some people say it's three genes. And we really won't know because nobody has the money to map the genome for American chestnut or the other chestnut species.
Okay, now the second part. I've been planting chestnut seeds for 30 years, and in that time, I have planted no less than 25 in a year, and like the year we had all the rain, I think it was 93, I had 200 in the ground, and they all drowned, but most of the time, I can get them out of the ground, and that ends it. I planted 30 in the fence row 2 years ago. I replanted some this spring. I think there are four alive. They get 4 inches high. They get four leaves on it, and they set there. Now, these trees are 4 to 5 years old. I have one old tree. I just looked at it before I come in to make the call. Tomorrow, I will drive 35 miles. There are two separate locations on public property where there are two mature trees, only two, and I will take catkins off and bring it back and have a little tree sex. Last year I produced 29 nuts of my own, but I can't get them to grow. They come out of the ground and they won't go. Now I have my next good tree is 3 feet tall, and I see now it's all turned yellow, so it's belly up.
Well, yeah. Don, are you on flat land? That's part of the problem, is that the chestnut ecologically is adapted to hill country, and that's one of the reasons we find it throughout Appalachia. It had an ecological advantage to live in those areas, partly because the soil is better drained. It doesn't chestnut doesn't like wet feet, and a lot of rain will really wipe out your trees. And if you look carefully at the traditional range of chestnut, it goes into little pockets of Illinois, but then it stops because as soon as the hills stop, chestnut stops. You can see this in Virginia. You can see this in Ohio. And so growing, and in fact, even in the 1920s and 30s when they started breeding programs for chestnut, USDA planted a whole mess of chestnut somewhere out in the Midwest on flat land, and they failed quickly.
Military. All right, there you have it. Thanks, Don, for calling. I appreciate it. Doug Beege, our guest today, Douglas Beege, is the author of If a Tree Falls, Rediscovering the Great American Chestnut. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking today about the American chestnut tree with our guest, author Dennis Beege. He authored If a Tree Falls, Rediscovering the Great American Chestnut. If you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And let's go to Joseph in La Crosse next. Joseph, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. You're welcome. Good morning. And I just wanted to say thank you both to you for having the show and to your guest, because when I was a little kid, which was a very long time ago, growing up in New England in Massachusetts, we had a little area of chestnut trees not too far from my house that my brother and I used to play in, and I loved those trees. And they made it to probably the early 1970s before they were gone. And it was just, it's probably my most fun tree memory as a little kid. And certainly picking chestnuts up and playing in them and everything else was just totally cool. There was about 12 of them right in a small area, and they were amazing trees. They were just great, and it was a lot of fun. So thank you guys for what you're doing, because that's a big deal.
Thank you very much for calling, Joseph. And Doug, it is a big deal.
It is a big deal. And I think that's part of the passion. The people I met when I was researching the book, like John Elkins in West Virginia, who's a chestnut grafter, wonderful guy, incredible pride in being a West Virginian, but his stories of his grandparents and his family gatherings where the family would talk about chestnut. The loss of chestnut for the Appalachian people, it was a huge hole in their lives, and it still is. I met people up in the hills hiking in the Appalachian Trail, a guy named Tom Cannon who was in his 80s, and he would tell me about favorite trees he had known growing up in North Carolina, and you could see tears in his eyes as he was explaining how important those trees were to the family, and then they were gone.
Yeah, and then they were gone. Thanks, Joel. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Lisa in... I'm sorry, Luba in Madison is up next, so let's go there. Luba, hi.
Hello. I have a question. Now, my parents moved from Monona Village in 51. And our neighbor had chestnut trees in, I believe, in front of their yard, and their house set back about maybe 150 feet or something like that. It was quite a ways. And it was called the Evergreens. And I know that it had no chestnuts that you could eat. But they didn't seem to be of gigantic size. And could you describe the leaves for me?
Well, the cover of my book has a picture of a chestnut tree. The chestnut has a serrated, like a toothed outer edge.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a saw blade, I guess you could say. The shape, boy, it's what I imagine a UFO looks like. That probably doesn't help people.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's not a rind. It's a sort of elongated
oval.
Oval.
I'd say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sort of almond shaped with edges.
I think you could say that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was my impression that it was always a chestnut tree because I remember I couldn't get chestnuts from it. And that was always disappointing.
It may have been another type of chestnut.
It could have been a Chinese chestnut. It could have been a Japanese chestnut. It could have been a European chestnut.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I like them. And but I have a house that's just, Cape Cod 1.5 story, and I don't know whether that would fit in.
But for a chestnut, well?
Well, once again, it depends on how... your soil is, if your soil's well drained, if, these things like a lot of light. It's something that a lot of people don't know, but the woods of Appalachia are still filled with chestnut.
Hmm.
It's amazing when I was walking through there that I was looking at all the big trees, and then I didn't realize I was surrounded by chestnuts, but they're all about knee high.
Oh.
Some of those trees are 50 or 60 years old. They're knee high. So it's almost as if a giant has become doomed to be a dwarf for the rest of existence. And, you just think it's some little shrub. You wouldn't think anything special about it. That's the same American chestnut that used to be really big. So you can try them, but I wouldn't expect a lot of success in small, not really bright, sunny, flat areas.
No. Thanks very much for calling. What's the difference between the American chestnut and the Chinese chestnut, by the way?
Well, the Chinese chestnut has been cultivated for thousands of years, so that the Chinese chestnut is a much shorter tree, probably more akin to like our apple trees.
Okay.
Easier to pick the fruit, doesn't produce really good lumber, whereas the American chestnut, like the white pine and other trees that had been here in forests for millennia before white folks got here... those trees had a lot of competition amongst each other, so they grew very tall to get to the canopy. And as they did, they would set annual rings, fairly tight annual rings every year, and create some fairly giant trees that were remarkable for their timber. Mm. And, you can make telephone poles and things like that out of them. The chestnut was also interesting because it was rot-resistant. So it was used for a lot of buildings and rail fences and stuff like that. The Chinese chestnut simply wouldn't have been used for those things as much.
Gotcha. Carmen in McHenry, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Carmen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. In relation to lumber, I used to heat my shop with wood. I was cutting trees down, and I said to a lady, these trees are too nice to burn. Cut them down, she says, or I'm going to get somebody else to do it. I have a large pile that I would like to dispose of white oak, red oak, and black walnut that's been in a heated garage and planed for over 20 years. I built a real large workbench, like 25 feet long and 10 feet high out of it, but I can't seem to find anybody that would be interested in having this wood. Where do I go to find somebody that would be interested in a nice pile of planed hardwoods?
Wow. It's a little off our topic, but Douglas, any suggestions?
Stopper Shopper? Maybe list it on eBay? Any place you go, you have plenty of places. People will buy wood like that.
I mean, it sounds like wonderful wood. That's for sure.
Yeah.
If for nothing else, somebody's heating with wood that's been that sitting that long in a dry spot would be ideal.
Heating with black walnut is. I'd have a lot of difficulty doing that.
I would too, I guess. So you're going to have to rely on local advertising or maybe go on eBay, Carmen. Good luck. Thanks for calling. Larry in Eau Claire is up next. Hi, Larry.
Hi. About 20 years ago, a friend of mine gave me a chestnut seedling, and I planted it on the edge of my yard. And it's probably 30 feet tall now. And in the fall, I get chestnuts falling. Now, what's the difference between a chestnut tree and a horse chestnut? And I guess the second question is, how do you prevent the blight?
First off, horse chestnut and American chestnut. Horse chestnut is in the genus Aeschylus. American chestnut's in the genus Castanea. They cannot breed. They are very different plants. My suggestion would be to look them up in any kind of simple tree guide, and you'll see very different plants. How do you prevent the blight? You could possibly build a silo, a greenhouse around your tree, seal the doors, prevent anybody from going in or out. How do you prevent the flu? How do you prevent any type of disease from moving around? It's really difficult. Viruses, bacteria, fungi, they have a way of moving around they're far more mobile than we are. And
there's no magic elixir that you can feed into the roots or tap into the tree.
Believe me, in the 19-teens, when chestnut blight was marching across states like Pennsylvania, people would try anything. They would cover them with a copper sulfate solution. They would put baby powder on their trees. And interestingly, as I detail in the book, people would, flim-flam artists would go around to people with chestnut trees and say, hey, for $500, I can do this special treatment for your tree. They'd take chalk dust or something colorful, and they'd spray it on the bark and maybe put it around the roots of the tree and say, oh, well, look, I've just saved your chestnut tree. That'll be $300. Mm-hmm. They'd pocket the money, and they'd quickly move out of town before somebody realized that chestnut was going to die anyway.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Tom Volk in La Crosse, your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Doug. This is...
Hey, Tom.
I've talked to you guys before. I haven't been on the show for a while. I talked to Jim, maybe get on there sometime. But in any case, I'm a mycologist at UW-La Crosse, and we're doing... And you guys were talking earlier about the fact that if you transplant chestnut seeds into certain places, they're not going to grow. And in my lab, we've done quite a bit of work on the fungi that are associated with the roots of these trees that allow them to grow. So we think that it's... we've been working in the West Salem stand and finding that the fungi that are associated with the trees are what are allowing them to grow in that area, which made them thrive very well. So I'm wondering, is anybody else working on this sort of thing, looking at these, what we call mycorrhizae, this association with the roots?
Tom Volk's in the book too, and he's a fantastic mycologist, and I still very much treasure meeting him at the stand at West Salem. But Tom, the question about the mycorrhizae, my question for you is: have you or through your lab made mycorrhizae available to other people?
No, and that's actually very difficult to do because it's really hard to grow them. Most of them are obligate mycorrhizae, which means that they require a living tree in order to produce their spores, in order to even grow. And so what I would recommend is taking soil from a place where there's a chestnut when you plant a chestnut tree, and you're very likely to get the spores or the fungi that you need to make that successful. There's also a lot of evidence that if you plant out the chestnut trees, they'll tap into the existing mycorrhizae of the oaks, so they can actually share the fungi between the oaks and the chestnuts. So if you plant in an area where there's been oak, you're very likely to get them growing as well because they're in the same family. They're very closely related.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, I'm a plant person, but by writing this book about American chestnut tree, I found myself having to learn a lot about the kingdom of fungi because the chestnut blight, Cryphonectria, is a fungus, and it was responsible for this incredible ecological catastrophe. But like Tom Volk's saying, the mycorrhizal fungi, the soil fungi that can bring water and other minerals to the roots of the trees are really vital for those trees surviving. It's a really interesting question. We're also on the cusp of understanding the fungi. It's almost as if this is a whole new area of exploration, and it's becoming more mainstream. I myself was inspired by Tom and some other people to actually start growing my own mushrooms because I found out how easy it was. I'd never thought about it, but I had a stump in my backyard, and I plugged in some spores, and I got mushrooms now.
Yeah, so there's a lot more information about these fungi. My student, John Palmer, got his master's degree working on the chestnut fungi and put up a webpage called chestnutfungi.net that you can read more about his work on the mycorrhizae.
So that's
really pretty. He did a really good job.
Chestnutfungi.net?
Right.
Tom, thanks.
Okay, good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. So there's another source of information. You know, I should mention in your book, maybe you could, just before we go take some more calls, give us a thumbnail on the book itself. You really trace some history. But go ahead, tell us.
Wow. Yeah, the book took on a life of its own. It starts out basically with my introduction to the tree and how I found it in West Salem and my experience with it. Very personal. Then it goes into a history of how the blight struck in 1904, how people in the East Coast responded to it, which was a pretty interesting history. There's a lot of strange interactions that people had and weird politics, and we don't want to throw money at this problem. We need to take action right now, even though if we don't know what we're doing. It's eye-opening. And then there's a long period of lull where we had kind of just given up. And then in the 1960s and 70s, renewed interest in chestnut started the founding of the American Chestnut Foundation and the American Chestnut Cooperatives Foundation. So the later chapters, I went to Virginia and I worked with these groups for a few weeks each and just sat there. I did all the work they did, and then I would sit at home at night and just write all the experiences of the day. I was really lucky. Fred Hebert is the chief breeder at the American Chestnut Foundation Farms in Meadow View, Virginia. Very intriguing guy, wonderful role model for me, just a very passionate, intelligent, ecological thinking plant breeder. And then I switched off and I went east to Blacksburg, Virginia, and I hung out with Lucille and Gary Griffin of the American Chestnut Cooperators Foundation. Now, each of those organizations gets a chapter in the book. It's interesting, since they're trying to solve a similar problem, they still have completely different approaches, and they're at odds with one another.
Don't necessarily get along.
Yeah, not necessarily happy to be with each other. And that animosity in some ways impedes their project and in some ways fuels it at the same time. The American Chestnut Foundation is pretty much Goliath in the field. They're big. They've got a lot of state chapters, and they reach far, and they do a lot of fundraising. The American Chestnut Cooperators would be more like David. Small, mobile, but underfunded, understaffed. And in some ways, it looks like they're not going to be able to pull off what they want to do. Though, of the two organizations, I think, ecologically speaking, the American Chestnut Cooperators have really clued in a lot of good things. They're growing their trees not on a farm like the Chestnut Foundation. They're growing them in the wild, where they will eventually have to live anyways. The American Chestnut Foundation wants to grow their trees on a farm, then move them to wild areas, which creates all kinds of difficulties. How are they going to plant them? How are they going to watch these trees and take care of them? Then also, there are chapters, our own Mark Shepard here, who lives out in Richland Center, near Richland Center, and he's a self-titled agroforester who believes that we can get rid of corn and soybeans, which are energy-intensive crops, and start growing permanent crops of chestnut and hazelnut. And an intriguing character in our own backyard. And I learned a lot from him. Then eventually I wind up the book basically with developing my own environmental ethics view, taking my education and applying it to this problem. I gotta say, I'm not what most people would consider an optimist when it comes to these ecological problems. Chestnut tree, there's a lot of work going to save this one species. At the same time, we understand that maybe 10% of tree species the world over could be gone within the next 100 years. 1 out of 10 species of tree extinct. That's kind of a bleak prospect, and my observation is that we don't seem to be putting a lot of energy towards that problem. We seem to be creating other problems. And
that pretty well lays out your book and how it's and you've got a lot of interesting stories to tell within the book. How do people get copies, by the way?
Well, you can contact your local booksellers. In Madison, you could go to Rainbow Books. They have a couple copies sitting on the shelf right now. Otherwise, you know, any of the big book chains can order it for you. If you'd like to contact me via email, I can get you a copy. My email address, Doug, D-O-U-G, at djbuege.com. That's djbuege.com. And that's your best option.
Or just go to your local bookstore and ask that person to order a copy.
Yeah, If a Tree Falls.
If a Tree Falls. And, Doug, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And
well, thank you, Larry, for making time for it.
Really appreciate it. Douglas Beege of Madison, environmental philosopher with training in botany and genetics, and has authored If a Tree Falls, Rediscovering the Great American Chestnut. It's a fascinating story, and you got to learn about it. Learn a little bit more about it. And one of the nice things about the book, too, is he's got some photos in there of the tree and some of the work that's being done in the various spots, which I kind of liked as well. Douglas Beege, our guest. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at how you and I can prevent, how we can keep from poisoning ourselves. How's that for a program topic? And Donna Lotzer, our guest coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.